I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's here and now. The grim economic news just keeps on coming. Today, the government reported that the jobless rate reached 7.2% last month as the economy shed another 500,000 jobs. The news comes amidst growing concerns about how banks are using the bailout money from Washington. The head of a congressional panel overseeing the $700 billion program says lawmakers need to take a very hard look at how banks have used the money, because at this point, she says, we just don't know. Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Warren told ABC's Good Morning America she's still waiting for answers from the Treasury Department.
I'll be perfectly blunt with you. I'm shocked that we have to ask these questions. But what I will say is I'm not giving up on this.
That's Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Warren speaking today to ABC's Good Morning America. Benjamin Applebaum is banking reporter for The Washington Post. He joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
We just heard Elizabeth Warren expressing her concerns about the government bailout funds. What are her specific concerns here?
There are really three things that she is concerned about. The first is that Treasury is being extremely secretive about how it is allocating the money. The second is that it is not establishing, it's not requiring banks to report how they are using the money, which makes it very difficult to tell if the program is working. And maybe the thing she is most upset about is that Treasury has so far refused to spend any money on a program to prevent foreclosures, something that Warren and others regard as essentially defying the will of Congress when it allocated this money.
And the panel clearly not satisfied with what they've heard from the Treasury Department. This isn't the first time that Elizabeth Warren and her panel have asked Treasury for answers, correct?
No, indeed. This has something of the feeling of a teacher asking the same questions a second time in the hope of hearing better answers. This panel asked these questions in mid-December. Treasury sent back responses. And the panel is now essentially asking the same questions again. And it writes quite explicitly in this report that they are hoping that Treasury will be more forthcoming this second time around.
Now, you mentioned that the sharpest criticism in today's report is about foreclosure prevention, the fact that no money is being spent on foreclosure prevention. Did the original bailout plan, as written by Congress, include specific language on this?
It includes specific language. The problem is that, in general, Congress failed to write a bill that required the Treasury Department to do much of anything. So Congress said what it wanted. It talked at great length about what it wanted, but it wrote what frankly now seems like a flawed piece of legislation, at least relative to what Congress says it hoped would happen, in that it basically allowed the Treasury Department to decide what it wanted. And it has gone in a very different direction than Congress might have hoped. And so now Congress is left in the curious position of wanting a very different bill than it wrote in the first place.
She said that lawmakers need to take a hard look at how banks have used the money because at this point we just don't know. Is that really true? Do we really not know how this money is being spent or has been spent?
We really don't. We know isolated bits and pieces. We know some banks have come forward and said that they are doing one thing or another with the money. But by and large, what we know is that the Treasury Department has invested $270 billion in financial institutions, and very little of it has been accounted for.
It's shocking almost, isn't it? I mean, so much of this crisis has to do with a lack of regulation or regulatory failure. And here's a bailout plan offering hundreds of billions of dollars. And we're understanding that we don't know where the money's gone.
Well, this committee is certainly shocked by it. You heard Warren speaking about
sure.
It. They seem outraged that Treasury has been unwilling or unable to provide these answers. And it's very interesting. We have two Treasury departments right now. The outgoing one has been very defensive about all of this, has defended its approach so far. But there's an incoming Treasury Department now, and it has been much more receptive to these critiques. And we reported in the Post this morning, my colleague David Cho reported, that the new Treasury Department is now working on reforms to this program that will address many of these concerns.
And any sense of in what direction those reforms would go under Tim Geithner, the new Treasury Secretary?
We will clearly see some kind of program to spend government money attempting to prevent foreclosures. The exact shape of that is still being hammered out, but there will be something, and it will be big. We are likely to see much stricter controls on the way that companies can use these investments, and we are likely to see much clearer reporting on how they use it and how successful it is in restoring the health of the economy.
Well, Benjamin, thanks so much for helping us out today. It's much appreciated.
My pleasure.
That's Benjamin Applebaum. He's a banking reporter for The Washington Post, talking about how little is known about how banks are spending the billions of dollars in government bailout money, which leads naturally enough to a discussion about the need for regulatory and oversight reform. When President-elect Barack Obama spoke yesterday about the need for a massive stimulus package to revive the ailing U.S. economy, he also talked about the need to restore confidence in Wall Street and the nation's financial system.
We must also work with the same sense of urgency to stabilize and repair the financial system we all depend on. That means using our full arsenal of tools to get credit flowing again to families and businesses while restoring confidence in our markets. And it means reforming a weak and outdated regulatory system so that we can better withstand financial shocks and better protect consumers, investors, and businesses from the reckless greed and risk-taking that must never endanger our prosperity again.
President-elect Barack Obama speaking yesterday. It will be a difficult challenge given the subprime mortgage collapse, the loss of trillions of investor dollars, the absurdly high salaries for those Wall Street executives, and the failure of the regulators. Jesse Eisinger covers finance and Wall Street for Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine. He's just written about the failure of regulators and joins us now. Good to have you, Jesse.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Well, you've written about the flawed regulatory system, and you say the first thing the Obama administration needs to do is fire the regulators. You even go farther than that. You say blow up the current regulatory system and start from scratch. Tell us why you think the current system is so weak.
Well, there are two fundamental problems. One is that they're incompetent. The SEC has proven this most prominently and obviously with the Bernie Madoff affair. They had multiple times and chances to investigate that alleged Ponzi scheme. And that's what the SEC should be able to do. The Ponzi scheme is a pretty plain vanilla garden variety investing fraud. And if that's the one thing that we require the Securities and Exchange Commission to do, and if they can't do that to the tune of a fraud that may reach as much as $50 billion, then we have to really reevaluate their basic competency. And the other bigger problem, is that the structure of our financial regulation is all wrong. It's based on the kind of activity that a company does, a financial firm does. We have banking regulators, we have insurance regulators, we have securities regulators, and now, in the 21st century, many of these activities look like securities activities, look like insurance activities. They're all melding together. The walls that have divided these kind of businesses have broken down. And so we need a new regulatory system that regulates not based on the kind of business that these companies do, but the regulatory goals that we would have.
Well, I want to talk about sort of some ideas you have about how to reform. But first, you know, you mentioned the incompetence of regulators and how they missed that $50 billion Ponzi scheme. You mentioned in some reading that I did of yours two other critical moments when we should have overhauled our financial system. The first after the collapse of long-term capital management in 1998, and then again after the worldwide stock market crash in 1987. Both times there were calls for regulatory reform, but there was resistance from the finance industry. How do we get around that this time?
Well, this time the financial industry is much weaker. We have had a series of warnings going back over two decades now about the precariousness of the financial system. And, you know, when I talk about missing the Madoff affair, that's a sort of tangible, obvious example of regulatory failure. But the much greater regulatory failure is to allow the banking system to become this precarious and to allow the investment banks to have become so leveraged and so thinly capitalized that they could fail so quickly. And we had warnings about this for decades, but now we've had the failure of all the independent investment banks. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley are still independent, but they've become banks. So the federal government has taken stakes, although very timorously, as we just heard, in banks around. around the country. And so now what we need to do is flex some government muscle to impose a new regulatory regime on the financial industry that prevents this kind of implosion that would take the entire economy with it.
Well, let's talk about that. You suggest that we learn from places like Australia and the Netherlands and implement something called the twin peaks approach to regulation. What's that?
Yeah, so what those guys do is they have a sort of good cop, bad cop regulator. One regulator looks at the kinds of things the SEC looks at now, but across all financial industries. So that's the kind of misleading disclosures, insider trading, those kind of things, legal enforcement things, investor protection. And what I argue is that one peak of our regulatory structure should have an agency that sort of subsumes the SEC within it, but then looks at the lying and the cheating and the manipulation. And we do that okay right now with the SEC, not very well, but that would be one peak. But then the thing that we've left out completely from our regulatory system is the other peak, which is a kind of safety and soundness peak. And that's looking at the balance sheets of financial companies to see whether they're capitalized well, to see whether they're taking risks with trading partners that they shouldn't be taking. And that's the kind of peak, twin peaks model that you have. So you have that sort of regulatory agency that goes in and is kind of the hard-nosed enforcement types, and then you would have a sort of an agency that might work a little bit more with firms and have some more market savvy and understand whether there's a precariousness in an individual bank or individual insurance company. And, you know, the regulators do some of that now, but it's not very effective.
Hmm. Now, Obama, as we just heard, has spoken about the need for reform. And I'm wondering what you expect from the administration, if you're sanguine at all about what we can expect. And let me just read you one paragraph from the op-ed of the New York Times yesterday. There are no prominent consumer or investor advocates among Obama's top economic advisors, except for Paul Volcker, the former Federal Reserve Chairman. There are no officials or regulators, past or present, who have distinguished themselves by giving early warnings of the impending catastrophe or taking strong actions against the excesses that were fueling it. Do you share those concerns?
That's absolutely correct. Obama has had a good rhetorical track record. He gave a speech at the Cooper Union University in March of last year, outlining a bunch of financial regulatory goals that were quite ambitious and impressive. But the people that he has to implement this regulatory overhaul that he's spoken about presenting at some point by April of this year is, you know, the people are unimpressive.
Hmm.
His SEC appointee Mary Shapiro is a lifelong regulator, by all accounts, a decent and hardworking person. But
Jesse, hang on there with that thought. We'll be back in a moment. We need to take a quick break. Jesse Eisinger, a senior writer for Condé Mass Portfolio, will be back in a moment. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Welcome back. We're talking to Jesse Eisinger about the need for regulatory reform and how to restore confidence on Wall Street. And Jesse, just to continue on the point you were making before the break, many of the people at the top of Obama's economic team, including Larry Summers, who he's picked to be his chief economic advisor, has been a fairly strong opponent of regulation. Does that worry you?
Yeah, although it seems like they've had some deathbed conversions about this crisis. So the question with Obama is whether the rhetoric is going to match the action, because the rhetoric is good. The action seems somewhat unimpressive now. The appointees are not great, but they're a huge improvement over the Bush administration.
Mm.
It's a lot of big talk now, and what we want to do is see some ambitious action. They haven't been very ambitious yet. But maybe that will change.
Jesse, one quick question before we let you go, in literally the 20 seconds we have left. We often hear comparisons made again and again about the current crisis being the worst since the Great Depression. Do you buy that? Are we really teetering on the edge of something that severe?
We're certainly teetering on the edge of it. It's obviously not the Great Depression yet. It's the Great Recession so far. But we've had a terrible banking crisis and failure. And without major action and major overhaul, we're headed that way.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Jesse Eisinger covers finance and Wall Street for Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine. To read his article on regulation reform, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, for some Americans, the current financial crisis is triggering memories of the Great Depression of the 1930s. Here and Now's Andrea Shea found some Boston-area residents who lived through those troubled times, and she produced this audio montage.
I'm Michael Kushner. I was born in 1918, so that makes me 90 years old. And in 1930, I was 12 years old, in the height of the Depression. That was the Great Depression. In this area here in Boston, everybody was poor.
They were poor and poorer and destitute. My name is Betty Lederman. I'm 89 years old. I was in Brooklyn, New York, during the Depression. My father was a carpenter. Sooner or later, he did lose his job, and it was up to us to go to work.
I was in high school. I graduated in 31, and I got a job. My name is Ethel Reed. I'm 95 years old. During the Depression, I spent most of my life in Hyde Park, which is a part of Boston. I remember that my father, who was a railroad engineer and had worked usually 6 days a week in those days, he was cut back to 2 days a week. That, of course, made a big difference in our finances.
It was a rough time. I'm Pearl Cosby Russo. I was born on January 21st, 1912. My father and mother had a little neighborhood grocery store. During the beginning of the Depression, about 1929, many of the people who shopped in the store, they would get what we used to call credit. And my father had slips of paper and would write down how much they owed. And many of them didn't pay. My father had no money to pay the bills. And he was devastated that he would have to declare bankruptcy, and he committed suicide. And my mother went into a deep depression from which she never recovered.
My father was in the produce business. We had fruit and vegetables, so we didn't starve to death, you know.
At that time, potatoes were 25 pounds for a quarter, so you could manage somehow to put food on the table, nothing fancy. But I had a friend who could not go back to school because she did not have shoes. Was not unusual to see somebody's furniture out on the sidewalk because they couldn't pay the rent. Landlords were desperate. Everybody was looking for ways to get some money.
Steal, beg, or borrow, got till tomorrow. Landlord's a mean old gent. It's come to a showdown, and he wants the lowdown if I'm raising my rent.
There were no jobs, nothing to do.
Many of my friends lost their houses. Unlike the people who are losing their houses today, those people had worked hard and didn't live beyond their means, but they were the people most sorely affected.
The difference between then and now is that people's expectations before the Depression were not as high as people's expectations today. There wasn't this talk about the American dream of owning a house.
Of course, in those days, if you had a bank account and the bank failed, there was no FDIC to bail you out. It was a total loss. This should never have happened.
And it's just heartbreaking to see that happening. It's greed, 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 greed.
We don't have a sense of community today as we did in the 30s and 40s. Despite the fact we had no money, it was rich, and we had many friends who were in the same boat as we were. And there was a sense of people helping each other. You shared whatever you had. It was very little, but we enjoyed ourselves, even though We were very, very poor, according to today's standards.
People now who have lost their jobs, they're going to have quite a number of weeks of unemployment, which is a great help. There was nothing like that. There was nothing. For the people during the Depression, there was zero. Now, they are not as bad off as they think they are. That is by comparison.
Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal, buddy, can you spare a dime?
A new Pentagon study warns of a new nuclear risk. It says top defense officials have undermined the credibility of U.S. nuclear deterrence by failing to understand its value. The report warns this could lead to a new wave of nuclear proliferation because more than 30 nations in Europe and Asia rely on America's nuclear umbrella to defend them. Fear of the atom bomb seems like something out of the Cold War, but the nuclear threat has actually grown since then. And even foreign policy hawks like Henry Kissinger have started arguing for a nuclear-free world. So has Jan Lodal. Lodal is a former senior Defense Department official at the White House in the Nixon, Ford, and Clinton administrations. He's co-authored an essay, Mapping the Route to a World Without Nukes, and he joins us now. And Jan, is this really possible? Isn't the nuclear weapons genie out of the bottle? Can we get it back in there?
Well, we can't get the genie back in the bottle, but I think a better analogy is that we can build a bigger bottle that will confine the genie that's unfortunately threatening us now.
Lay out the challenge. How many nuclear weapons are out there?
Well, there's still about 25,000 nuclear weapons active in the world. That is down from the Cold War peak of nearly twice that number, but it's still a very large number. The real challenge, though, is not so much those numbers, most of which are held by the United States and Russia, but the real possibility that terrorist or an irresponsible state can get their hands on these weapons because the technology is now widely known. So if we're going to have a control regime, which we must have, that keeps these weapons out of the hands of dangerous players, we have to have a different approach.
And what would that be? You lay out a sort of four-step program to address this issue. Let's go through that. What do you propose to get to this zero nukes world?
The first thing we need to do is to obtain agreement from all the world states that the only valid purpose for nuclear weapons is to prevent the use of nuclear weapons by others, in other words, deterrence, and that there are no valid warfighting uses of nuclear weapons. From there, what we have to do is we have to develop a universal comprehensive regime that is the same for all states, including the United States. That's going to be very hard. We're going to have to accept some things that we haven't accepted in the past.
For example?
Well, for example, we do not, with a very few exceptions, open any of our nuclear facilities to multilateral international inspectors. And we're not going to be able to get all the rest of the nations of the world to accept international inspection if we refuse. We're going to also have to convince the other nuclear powers to do the same thing.
You also propose that the U.S. reduce its arsenal to 1,000 nuclear weapons, correct?
Well, if we accept the purpose that I have set forth, that nuclear weapons are for preventing the use of nuclear weapons by others, deterrence, and no other purpose, that 1,000 is adequate to meet our security needs if that's our purpose, and there would be no need to keep more than 1,000. I don't propose reducing to 1,000 just for the sake of reducing, but rather to demonstrate that we're serious about changing our view of the purpose of nuclear weapons so that we can have some credibility when we try to negotiate that with the rest of the world.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about, and that is the credibility issue and the challenge of the U.S. leading this initiative. I mean, how difficult do you view that? Given that, you know, the U.S. is the first country to develop nuclear weapons, to use nuclear weapons, how do we establish sort of the moral authority to say, okay, listen up, guys, no more nukes?
Well, if you look back at the history, we initially developed nuclear weapons because we were afraid that the Germans would get them first. So we also developed nuclear weapons initially to keep others from using them. The Soviet Union then saw that we had them. China saw that the Soviet Union had them. India saw that China had them. Mm-hmm. Pakistan saw that India had them. So what's easy, I think, is for us to acknowledge that the real purpose of these weapons is deterrence and not war fighting. During the Cold War, there were many efforts to try to generate war fighting scenarios, but none of them really worked even then, and now they're really quite nonsensical. That's easy. What's harder is to get the new control regime negotiated.
It seems like you put your finger on the big challenge, this sort of other guy problem. How do we deal with that, this idea that Pakistan has nuclear weapons because India does, and India has them because China does, and so on and so on? How do you break that kind of chain?
Well, you break that chain by not asking any powers, including ourselves, to get rid of their nuclear weapons, or certainly not to get rid of the core that they need to serve this legitimate purpose of deterrence until everyone else has agreed to get rid of their weapons. And then you put in place this control regime. The very same control regime that can verify that no one has nuclear weapons can also verify that the reductions to zero are happening as agreed.
Why zero? Why zero nuclear weapons as opposed to just a very tough regime to control nuclear weapons?
The problem is that there is a legitimate use for nuclear weapons, as I've said, to prevent the use of nuclear weapons by others. And as long as any states have nuclear weapons, eventually other states will feel that they need nuclear weapons for deterrence purposes themselves. So there's no real way to stop proliferation unless all states agree to give up their nuclear weapons.
It seems, though, like the big challenge here will be going from the 1,000 to zero.
That's why you have to have this control regime in place. If the control regime is good enough and strong enough, and I believe it can be made so, to ensure that there are no nuclear weapons, it will make this process of reducing step by step those last 1,000 weapons acceptable to all the nuclear powers.
Hmm. The U.S. and the European Union have been struggling for several years to prevent Iran and North Korea from acquiring nuclear weapons with limited success. Would your approach help those challenges?
I think it would help. I think that if the United States made clear that we are heading toward a world of no nuclear weapons, which the president-elect has said in his campaign on numerous occasions that he would welcome such a world, if we made this our official policy, that it would add some credibility to our efforts to prevent these states from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Let's talk about Barack Obama's position. In the course of the campaign, he's talked about being in favor of ratification of the Test Ban Treaty and that he wouldn't authorize building any more nuclear weapons. Is that enough?
No, that's not enough. In the first instance, people forget that the bomb we dropped on Hiroshima had never been tested. The one we tested was a plutonium bomb. We used a uranium bomb. The Nagasaki bomb was the first plutonium bomb. So you can build nuclear weapons with uranium, which would be the main thing a terrorist would likely do, without testing and have high confidence that they can be made to work. Second, all the nuclear powers have agreed unilaterally not to test anymore. And most of the other traditional non-proliferation efforts don't really go to the capabilities of the terrorists and of the irresponsible states that are trying to develop their nuclear weapons. We need to focus on our real needs here, which are for this comprehensive regime and to get the world to renounce the uses of nuclear weapons other than deterrence and make that the primary focus of our diplomacy.
Well, Jan Lodal, thanks so much for coming in to talk about this. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
Jan Lodal is the immediate past president of the Atlantic Council of the United States. He has served as senior Defense Department and White House official in the Nixon, Ford, and Clinton administrations. To see his article in Foreign Affairs magazine, go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. The Florida Gators are the champs of the college football world for the second time in three seasons. They defeated the Oklahoma Sooners last night in the Bowl Championship Series in Miami. If that wasn't enough for you football fans, don't despair. There are four NFL playoff games this weekend to keep you glued to the couch and tethered to your chips and beer. It's not funny, Bill. Here to preview them.
It's a very funny image.
Here to preview those games as well as the rest of the week in sports is Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. That was him cackling in the background. Bill, nice to see you, as always.
It's wonderful to be here, Anthony.
Okay, let's start with last night's BCS game. The number 2 ranked Florida beat number 1 ranked Oklahoma. Has this stopped the argument about who the national champions of college football are?
Well, I certainly hope the arguing won't stop. Winters are cold, and arguing gets the blood circulating, and I know there's some people in Utah still arguing that Utah is the number one team since they were undefeated this season, and that's the sort of arguments that, keep the juices flowing. That's a good thing.
When you're digging out of 8 feet of snow, I guess it's good to have something to keep.
Absolutely. Something to take your mind off the miserable
Absolutely.
Weather.
Okay, let's move on to the NFL. Bill, this weekend's game in the AFC, the conference-leading Tennessee Titans host the Baltimore Ravens on Sunday. The San Diego Chargers travel to Pittsburgh to play the Steelers. Who do you like to win the AFC?
Well, a little background on this. Last week on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce, who knows a great deal more about pro football than I do, of course, so does the chair you're sitting on. But anyway, he made his picks, and they were all wrong. Hmm. So I think it would be presumptuous of me to make any picks at all, and it would also open me up to all manner of ridicule later on, should you care to retain the tape of what we're talking about here.
That said, however.
I think Pittsburgh's going to win the Super Bowl. I say that because my brother-in-law and sister-in-law are giant Pittsburgh Steelers fans, and I wish good things for them, especially since the Patriots didn't even get a crack at it this time around.
All right, Charlie Pierce, put that in your pipe and smoke it. But we must, however, mention the NFC. The Arizona Cardinals travel to North Carolina to play the Panthers. And Sunday, the reigning champion New York Giants host the Eagles. We all remember how the Giants stunned New England to win last year's Super Bowl. You don't see them repeating.
Well, I don't know. It's always possible, of course. But I'm always interested in the Giants because as long as there's a Manning active in the postseason, I'm interested. The ultimate game, of course, we'll see Manning v. Manning. I understand they're supposed to play in the Pro Bowl, and it may be the world's first interesting Pro Bowl.
Hmm. Okay, let's move on to basketball. We have sometimes been accused on this program of being a little Boston-centric.
No.
I don't know why. Doesn't everybody love the Red Sox? I don't get it.
Doesn't everybody hate the Celtics and the Patriots?
But I have to ask, speaking of the Celtics, what is going on with them? They were last year's NBA champs. They started this season winning 19 games in a row. Now they've dropped 6 of 8, including the last 3. Tonight they meet the Cleveland Cavaliers, leading the Eastern Division. What's going on with the Celtics?
Well, I suppose if Celtics fans are inclined to panic, this is as good a time as any to do so. They've obviously, as you say, not only lost some games, they've lost some games at home, which is a dreadful development. In some of those games, they didn't rebound very well, and the games were close, and not getting a few more rebounds could have been the difference. And in at least one of those games, they had great shots, good looks, and an incredible number of balls that bounced in and out and rolled around the rim and then fell out. This happens. The basketball season is a very long grind, and you're going to have a stretch where the refs don't seem to see things your way or the ball doesn't seem to bounce your way. This is certainly a good enough team to put a bad stretch behind them, and I don't think there's any real reason to panic at this stage.
And finally, Bill, on a lighter note, there was a great story this week about a 72-year-old California woman and a rare baseball card of a team photo of the Cincinnati Red Stockings. Tell us about this.
Possibly the oldest baseball card ever. This is a woman who, she and her husband deal in what might charitably be called junk. They buy the contents of storage lockers that people have abandoned. In one of them, she found a baseball card of sorts, possibly the oldest card ever. It may be worth in six figures. Only the action on eBay will tell.
Wow. Six figures. Hold on to those old cards. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Thanks, as always.
Thank you, Anthony.
Still to come, the year ahead in entertainment. That's still ahead, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. In tough economic times such as these, can the entertainment industry convince people to spend? The industry hopes the answer is yes, but it's hedging its bets as it prepares for the next 12 months. There are major releases planned, including a new thriller from John Grisham, new music from Bruce Springsteen and U2, and the sixth Harry Potter film. Wall Street Journal entertainment editor and columnist Christopher Farley joins us to talk about the year ahead in entertainment. Hi, Christopher.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What's the answer to the question that was posed by your paper? Can people afford to entertain themselves this year?
Well, the answer is a definite maybe. In some areas, definitely people will probably go out and they will buy things. In the area of video games, video games haven't taken the kind of hit that some other areas of entertainment have. People still seem willing to stay at home and play a video game. They got some big ones coming out this year, like The Sims 3 and also StarCraft 2 and a new installment of the Grand Theft Auto series. But the jury's out on whether they'll go out there and buy books and go to movies and do some of these other things. And that's what the whole entertainment industry is anxiously waiting to see what will happen.
Well, let's take it sort of industry by industry. Let's start with the movie industry. Obviously experiencing its worst economic slump in decades. There were a lot of releases that were delayed in 2008. Why?
You know, because some releases were delayed, that will make this year a bigger year. For example, the new Harry Potter film, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, was pushed back from the end of the year all the way to the summer. And the studio explained that the reason they did that is because, you know, the summer's a bigger time for tentpole family films. And they also felt like the writer's strike had impacted what they were doing, and so they needed to revive it in the summer instead.
Let's just play a quick clip. This is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince.
Did you know, sir? Then?
Did I know I just met the most dangerous dark wizard of all time? No.
Another film that people are eagerly anticipating is Star Trek, and that's part of a gambit that's going on where people are focusing on origin films, films that tell you stories about characters you thought you knew. Star Trek plays into that because you won't see a lot of the old actors you knew from the original series. Instead, all the parts are being recast by newer actors, younger actors, actors in their 20s and 30s. They tell you the beginnings of Spock and Kirk and all these characters we've all come to love.
Prepare to fire all weapons.
I like this ship.
It's exciting.
Space is disease and danger wrapped in darkness and silence.
Buckle up.
So newer, younger actors playing in movies about an old theme. So something old and something new for everybody.
Yeah, and you still will see Leonard Nimoy. He pops up in the film and he pops up in the trailer. So he's got a part. But there still will be younger actors playing these roles of these characters in their youth.
And then, Chris, we can look forward to this guy. Let's listen.
We in Kazakhstan are very big fans of your Premier Bush. We think he is not only a wise man, but also very strong, although perhaps not as strong as his father, Barbara.
That, of course, is our good friend Sacha Baron Cohen as Borat. He's due back in theaters this year. What's he doing?
Well, he's back as a character that's familiar to many of his fans, Bruno, the gay fashion celebrity journalist. You know, it's going to be tough for him because, you know, can he still shock us? Can he still surprise us? Can he still interest us now that we know what his game is? We'll have to wait and see.
So that's the film industry. Let's move on to video games. You mentioned that this is the industry that might do best of all. Are video games the thing that is killing the film industry?
Well, you know, that's one theory because, you know, people only have so much time. Do they want to go out and pay for a taxi or gas and go out and see a movie and have to pay for dinner too? Or do they want to just stay in and just sit in front of The Sims 3 and just, you know, just veg out? Certainly the video game industry hopes that people want to do the latter. And they have a lot of big games, including a new version of Rock Band, which allows people to play the Fab Four. You can be, you know, Ringo, George, John. Who did I leave out there? There's one more.
Ringo, Paul, John,
yeah,
and Paul and George.
How could I forget Paul?
And Ringo and Paul.
You can play all of them in this new game, and that's the kind of thing that could cut across generational lines.
And the Wii console, still the hottest news in video games. What's coming out for Wii owners?
Wii Sports was very hot over the last few months, and now they're coming out with Wii Sports Resort, which will introduce some new sporting activities like water skiing and sword fighting, using the Wii's controllers. So it helps broaden out that whole game, which is really a phenomenon over the last few months.
Well, the video industry earned $10 billion last year. Is that a sign that it's still going gangbusters, or is it too slowing down in any way?
It's still expanding, but that expansion has slowed down. Though the video game industry seems to be in better shape than, say, the music industry, which has been slumping for a long time now in many ways, and the overall slump isn't going to help the music industry very much.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the recording industry. Here's a clip from one of the megastars. Let's listen.
Out here the nights are long, the days are lonely. I think of you, I'm working on a dream. I'm working on.
That, of course, is Bruce Springsteen. He's coming out with a new album later this month.
And a lot of other megastars are coming out with albums. Albums that were expected last year, they're finally coming out this year.
Such
albums
as?
By U2, mm-hmm. By Lily Allen, the British singer. Kelly Clarkson's coming out with a new album. Carlos Santana, Green Day, D'Angelo, and Amy Winehouse will probably be coming out with a new album, too, depending on whether she can get some of her personal demons under control. So it should be a very big year for these big names, and whether or not they can reach the kind of sales expectations they've had in the past, we don't know, but certainly there are a lot of big names out there.
Well, let's move on to publishing. Is this the year of the Kindle effect? And for listeners that don't know what the Kindle is, it's the electronic book reader, and if you want one, there's a two-month wait right now following Oprah's recommendation back in October. Is the Kindle effect having any kind of effect on book sales?
Certainly more people are turning to the Kindle, are reading books with the Kindle, but it's still a very small part of the overall book buying market. So that's another wait and see area to see how that all plays out, whether large chunks of people really turn to the Kindle in the end or whether it remains sort of really a specialized market.
Mm. And what are some of the hot titles coming out this year?
One of the hottest titles is the new Scott Turow book, The Associate. He's a guy that obviously sells a lot of units, but also get some critical respect. There's a new book coming out by author Colson Whitehead. You know, he's known for really brainy, smart writing. And in his new book called Sag Harbor, he takes a more personal turn and draws from his youthful experiences when he was vacationing in the area as a kid. And another book that people are talking about is a new book called The Kindly Ones, which is by an American author who wrote it in French. Is being translated back into English. It was a huge hit in Europe. It's about 1,000 pages long. So if you're looking for a big, weighty, challenging read, The Kindly Ones is one that critics are talking about.
All right, Christopher. Well, thanks so much for talking to us today.
I appreciate you having me.